Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's February 12, which means that it is Abraham Lincoln's birthday. He was born on this day 205 years ago. And this hour, we talk with the author of a fascinating new book. The story of John Hay and John Nicolay is the focus of this book. Prairie Boys, our guest writes, who met in 1851 and forged a close relationship that endured over a half century. Fortune placed them in the right place, Springfield, Illinois, at the right time, 1860, and offered a front row seat to one of the most tumultuous political and military upheavals in American history, then or since. They were Abraham Lincoln's private secretaries, and they had fascinating lives themselves. They also were so responsible in helping to create the image that we have of Abraham Lincoln now, and to give us a different way to interpret the Civil War rather than a states' rights war, that it was a war fought over moral issues. They wrote a 10-volume history of Lincoln's life. It took them many years to do that, and it has been considered a definitive history of the 16th president. So we're just delighted to have a discussion on Lincoln this hour. Our guest is John Zeitz, and John has taught American history and politics at Cambridge, Harvard, and Princeton. He's the author of several books on American political and social history. He's written for the New York Times, Washington Post, The New Republic, The Atlantic, Dissent, and American Heritage. And we'll be welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And Joshua, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
I love reading books about Abraham Lincoln, and I'm a great fan of this president, but I had never really, until your book, thought for very much time about John Hay and John Nicolay, and what was I missing? I was missing a lot, huh?
Well, these guys have always sort of been in the background. People who know a fair amount about Lincoln or about the Civil War era know who they are because they were ever present at his side, and they were really great letter writers and diarists, so we use them a lot to get an understanding of what Lincoln was doing and thinking at any given period. But they haven't really, up till now, they don't tend to be at the front of the story, and I was trying to do that so that we could tell the story a little differently.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you did. It's a fascinating book. And it's good that you did, because we also didn't realize, many of us, that they were so instrumental in defining what the story of Abraham Lincoln would be ever since their 10-volume history of his life was produced and serialized, right? They were important historical figures as well in giving us his history.
No, that's exactly right. We tend to think of Lincoln as always having been an enormously popular character who people agreed was, you know, one of the great, if not the greatest, presidents. But the truth of the matter is that he was deeply controversial while he was president. He presided over a civil war. You know, at least half the country thought that he was, you know, a tyrant. And in the North, there was, you know, sharply polarized politics. He had a very vocal Democratic opposition. And even within his own party, he wasn't universally loved. In the years after his death, the kind of official narrative that took hold by the 1870s was that he had been a very good man, but not a particularly strong wartime leader, and certainly not someone who had been suited to the times in which he governed. And so Hay and Nicolay really set out to try to correct that historical rendering, and they did it in conjunction with the Lincoln family, because they really felt that that kind of historical consciousness did the president a real misjustice.
Mm-hmm. They also were so instrumental in our framing the Civil War. I found it an interesting part of the book when you talked about the magazine articles and some of the writing that came out after the war was framing it in terms of, oh, weren't they all brave soldiers, the Confederates and the Union? And they were looking at many more of the moral issues, and there were so many. It was such a substantial war on so many fronts. It was much more than bravery of both sides, right?
Oh, that's exactly right. I mean, by the 1880s, the country was doing, you know, people were doing their best to try to reunify the United States, and in the service of doing that, you know, popular magazines, newspapers, lecture circuits, they really emphasized what Union and Confederate soldiers had in common, and they reduced the war to a scrap over kind of abstract constitutional issues, Hay and Nicolay believed firmly that the war had been first and foremost about slavery. That was no longer a very popular opinion to hold by the 1880s. And so they tried to put slavery back at the center of the Civil War narrative. And you know, they were very successful in creating an enduring image of Abraham Lincoln, one that lasted long, outlasted them, in terms of their portrayal of the Civil War as having been very much about the survival or the death of slavery. You know, that their success there kind of waxed and waned. They were really writing against the popular currents of the time, and their argument wouldn't become, you know, I think, conventional wisdom until the dawn of the second civil rights era, modern civil rights era in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to some of the early days. Talk about being at the right place at the right time in the right year. It was also fortuitous, wasn't it? Or some of it was just serendipity, that particularly with John Nicolay, who was captivated by Lincoln. I think it was the lost speech, which I want you to talk about, that he heard, and he describes the newspaper editors and everybody just putting down their pens, so captivated by what this man was saying, and in the audience was John Nicolay.
Yeah, so the you know, Nicolay and Hay, you know, to back up for a minute, they sort of came at this in very different ways. Nicolay was a German immigrant. He came to the United States when he was 6 years old with his parents, and by the age of about 12 or 13, he was orphaned, and so he could probably count on, you know, two hands the number of months he had spent in formal schooling. He was a self-made man in the same way Lincoln was. He started off, once he was orphaned, earning his keep as a printer's devil, which was sort of like a combination of errand boy and typesetter and clerk. Within 2 or 3 years, he actually was the publisher and the editor of this newspaper. Yeah, he was tremendously, I mean, he was just a, you know, tremendously ambitious guy. And he got swept up. You know, the newspaper began as a Whig newspaper and soon became a Republican newspaper. And he was swept up by the politics of the anti-slavery movement in the 1850s, which was the one burning issue of that political era. So he was an early anti-slavery political advocate. He, you know, even in his early 20s was already establishing a reputation for himself. And when basically in Illinois, as throughout the rest of the North, when there was this incredible political realignment and the Whig Party sort of dissolved and many Democrats fled the Democratic Party for the new anti-slavery Republican Party, Nicolay was at the front and center of that. He attended in 1856 the first statewide Republican convention in Illinois, where Lincoln gave this fiery anti-slavery speech. The people who were actually there were just in rapt attention. He later said that, you know, Lincoln held the audience in such rapt attention that the news reporters dropped their pencils and forgot their work. And it's called the lost speech because there's no transcript of it. Years later, somebody claimed to have a transcript of it, and Nicolay read it and said, no, that wasn't it. You know, I was there. But it was, you know, he was transfixed by Lincoln, and it was probably his first extensive exposure to Lincoln. He had met him before, certainly knew who he was, but this is the moment, I think, when Nicolay, you know, came to believe that Lincoln was the man of the moment.
And I love the way you described how more and more people came to believe that, and how a lot of it happened in Illinois, Chicago Convention, various speeches that he gave, what was happening in Springfield. It was as though, okay, people are beginning to realize who this man is, and he's just kind of sitting back and letting it all happen, because he can't do a lot of active campaigning and everything. But he, once people heard him, or maybe it was more than that, they realized there's really something to this man.
Well, we were talking about being in the right place in the right time. You know, Nicolay was in the right place in the right time. John Hay was in the right place in the right time. He had just graduated from Brown University. He was an old friend of Nicolay's. He was back. He told his parents that he wanted to be a poet, and they told him that he had to become a lawyer, which is, you know, probably something that's familiar to a lot of college graduates and their parents even today. So he went to clerk with it at his uncle's law firm, which is how you study the law back then. And that law firm happened to be in the, you know, in the same building as the offices of Lincoln and Herndon. So, I mean, he was very much in the right place in the right time. But in a sense, Lincoln and Hay and Nicolay were in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. You know, the Republican Party understood that to win the presidency in 1860, it would need to carry all the states that it carried in 1856, its first time out of the box as a new party, but it would also have to win two out of the three Midwestern states of Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. So there was a sort of growing consensus that you needed to run a Midwesterner who could carry some of those states. And not only was Lincoln the most prominent of those Midwesterners, or one of the most prominent, because of his failed but high exposure campaign against Stephen Douglas for the Senate in 1858, he was also literally, Springfield was at the epicenter of the political universe. If Illinois was the linchpin, Springfield was the linchpin within the linchpin, because it lay between the northern and southern portions of the state. The northern portions of the state tended to be strongly anti-slavery, populated by former New Englanders and New Yorkers, and the southern counties in the state, which were being fastly outpaced by the North. They were more southern facing. People tended to come from places like Kentucky. So they were literally just in the dead center of the state that was at the center of national politics. So all three men benefited from that.
Mm-hmm. Let's move into Washington for a moment, because it is remarkable that here you have all these people, Lincoln included, and these two young guys who, as you describe them, as gatekeepers to the president, don't really know their way around Washington. I'm sure there were a lot of politics at play in those days. So you got these kids coming in from Illinois who are at the apex of power. You've got a president who people are saying, you know, is a rail splitter from Illinois. There's something about him we kind of like, but he's doesn't seem very educated, and how can he be president? All three of them descending on Washington, it must have been quite a first few weeks for all of them.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, the post of presidential secretary was then a very powerful position. It doesn't sound powerful. We don't think of the term secretary as comporting a lot of power. But it was basically the equivalent in modern-day terms of a hybrid job involving being chief of staff, press secretary, political director, body man, all those things wrapped up in one. And, you know, normally the people who held that position were journalists or political activists who were political veterans or even former congressmen who had a great deal of inside Washington experience. Not only did the president-elect not have a great deal of experience, his presidential secretaries were completely unknown outside of Illinois. You know, in Springfield, they were seen as being very competent political actors, but not in Washington. So mm-hmm. They had a pretty steep hill to climb, and it didn't take long before they established themselves as a real force and a real power, and they effectively had to act as Lincoln's gatekeepers and the people who would say no and the people who would be his enforcers, particularly for Nicolay, who had a very abrasive personality, it didn't take long for people to take them seriously, even if they raised a little resentment mm-hmm. along the way.
And they had so many issues to deal with. I'm glad that you devoted some of the book, and I've always been fascinated by this time, so shed more light on it for us, please. The election, and then on December 20th, South Carolina seceding and other states seceding, so you're going to become president with this union that's falling apart. How did these gentlemen and the president deal with those months between the election and the inauguration?
You know, what's really striking is that Lincoln had been considered a moderate within his own party. He defeated several other candidates for the nomination, like Salmon P. Chase and William Seward, who were considered much more radical, much more stalwart anti-slavery men. So he came into this with a large number of Republicans thinking that he was a little more centrist on the slavery issue, which didn't suit, you know, help them carry the Midwest, but it didn't suit a lot of the party founders. And yet you had this irony that in December, as it became clear that South Carolina was leaving and that it was taking with it a number of other states, a lot of these mainline Republicans who had often always thought of themselves as more stridently anti-slavery than Lincoln, they began to panic, and they began sending letters to Lincoln in Springfield or visiting him in Springfield and saying, we've got to do something. You know, some of them said, let's extend the Missouri Compromise line right across the country. Everything south of it will be open to slavery. Everything north of it will be closed off. Some of them said, let's pass a constitutional amendment barring us from ever interfering with the institution of slavery in the states. And Lincoln, the one who everybody thought was so moderate, you know, basically said to them, let's cool down. Let's wait and see how this plays out. But we just won an election, you know, he said, on principles fairly argued, and we're not gonna give up at the threat of a bayonet or a gun what we just won at the ballot box. And if you read the letters that Nicolay was writing to his fiancée, in which he's recounting all of his conversations with Lincoln, who was by then the president-elect, you get a real sense that he was able to keep his calm and keep himself collected in a way that a lot of other more experienced Republican congressmen and governors were not able to do in those, mm-hmm. those weeks.
And then you have all that happening, and the first year in office, as you write, all of these military and political defeats, the president is badly bruised. This was a very rough time for his presidency, not that he didn't have others that were just as rough, but really hard.
Yeah, I mean, look, most presidents, particularly those who've come from outside of Washington, find that it's a very difficult job and that there are pieces of it that you didn't anticipate. But he had a whole host of complications. You know, he was the first president ever to have to fight a civil war. He was dealing with the actual practical implications of half the country simply leaving the federal system. He had to raise the money to fight the war. He had to take an army that only had 16,000 soldiers, many of whom were Southerners and went with the South. He had to turn that into a fighting force of 1 million people in the space of several months and feed them and clothe them and come up with the logistical means to move them and pay them. He had a Congress that was heavily Republican in the first 2 years of his presidency, but populated by people who thought that they were better politicians and better suited to the leadership role than he was. And you had a war that went very badly the first couple of months. The Union suffered grave setbacks, and he had generals, many of them Democrats, who were skeptical of his anti-slavery politics to begin with and who denigrated him behind closed doors. Some of them, like George McClellan, did it in front of him. So he faced a very, very difficult situation. And if you look at how Nicolay and Hay recorded it by the turn of the year in late December, 1861, as they were going into 1862, they felt it had been a pretty brutal first year in the White House.
Yeah, kind of an aside, but I've always wondered, why didn't President Lincoln just get rid of McClellan right away after he snubbed him like that? That's an incredible story.
Yeah, and hey, we don't, and here's an example of where these two guys left a lasting impression for us. The famous story of Lincoln going to visit McClellan at his house and McClellan going upstairs to bed and refusing to see him. No one knew that until Hay and Nicolay wrote about it 20 years
later.
Oh, really? That story came from them. And, of course, Hay was with Lincoln that evening, so he witnessed it firsthand.
Yes.
And actually, Hay said to him that night in the carriage ride home, it was Hay and William Seward, the Secretary of State, and Lincoln were in the carriage. And he basically said to him, "You've got to remove him. How can you let him do that? You're the commander-in-chief." And Lincoln basically said, "Look, if he wants me to hold his hat while he fights this war, I'll do that. We have to be patient." And so eventually, obviously, Lincoln did fire him twice. But Lincoln had his feeling was that if McClellan's ego needed to be soothed, he would soothe it if McClellan would fight.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest as well. If you'd like to join the conversation on this Abraham Lincoln's 205th birthday, Joshua Zeitz is here. He's written a fascinating book, Lincoln's Boys. That's how Lincoln referred to John Hay and John Nicolay. And the War for Lincoln's Image is the name of the book. They were, of course, Lincoln's private secretaries. They went with him from Springfield, Illinois, to Washington. And all of their lives after Lincoln's assassination, their lives continued to be immersed in Abraham Lincoln's life. They wrote, and it took a long time to do this, a 10-volume, incredibly valuable biography of Lincoln. And we're talking about them and about this president this hour of the show. Care to join us? Here's how you can do so. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lincoln's Boys this hour, John Hay, John Nicolay, and the War for Lincoln's Image. It has just been published by Joshua Zeitz, and we are welcoming phone calls. It may be the kind of conversation that you're listening to because a focus on these two is adding to our body of knowledge about Abraham Lincoln, and I'm glad he wrote the book. But feel free to join the conversation because his life, the way we think of the Civil War, His rise to the presidency, the actions during the presidency are all fodder for conversation this hour. 800-486-8655. Joshua writes, if anyone knew the inner mind of the president, it was these two gentlemen. They were witty and prolific letter writers. They were observant and incisive diarists, and they left a remarkable record of Lincoln's evolution as chief executive. I want to talk about their role as being sounding boards or as providing comfort. You write that Lincoln would go to them if there were things that were troubling him, or if he just wanted to talk about things, he would go into their room and just sit down and talk?
Yeah, you know, they actually lived on the second floor of the White House. This is a day and time before the construction of the West Wing that would separate out the president's staff, you know, rooms and the president's office from the living quarters. So back in these days, presidents lived and worked on the second floor, and their private secretaries normally lived up there as well on the other side of the building from the family quarters. And Lincoln, particularly as the war progressed, suffered, chronic insomnia, and he was up at night quite a lot and said that this is the only time he could get some quiet and actually think. And he used to go into Nicolay and Hay, each had their own office near his, but they shared a bedroom, and he used to pretty regularly go in and wake them up, or if one of them was there and the other was out of town, he'd wake up whomever was around. And, you know, they might talk politics, they might talk about the military situation, or they might just pass the evening telling jokes or reading poetry or reading Shakespeare. But he came to view them really as surrogate sons.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it astounding when you think about it, which you've thought about it a lot, Joshua, how they were present for all these phenomenally important historic events, you know, the Emancipation Proclamation, the Gettysburg Address, the death of children belonging to the First Lady and to the president, the whole Civil War, to be eyewitnesses to all of this in a very, very intimate way.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, they, early in the war, Nicolay wrote to his fiance, who was still living in Illinois, that he said that we're living in stirring times, but I don't always realize it, as these things are happening. And I think that was very much the case. They had an appreciation of the importance of the era they were living in, but they couldn't always on a day-to-day basis, on a moment-to-moment basis, realize it. You know, in 1863, Hay and Nicolay accompanied Lincoln to Gettysburg, where he delivered what we now know as the Gettysburg Address, dedicating the soldiers' cemetery. That was an important political moment for Lincoln. He was looking to the following year when he was going to attempt to get renominated for and reelected to the presidency, and that would make him the first president since Andrew Jackson actually pulled that off. And it was by no means certain that he was going to be renominated. So Hay and Nicolay's job at Gettysburg was to basically work the large crowd of northern state governors, congressmen, legislators, newspapermen, political activists who were going to converge on that town for the cemetery dedication. They were really there as his political aides, and so they spent the evening drinking quite a lot,
right? Yeah.
with all of these people, which was their job. But the next morning they were severely hungover, and so if you read their diaries, you know, you read Hay's diary, you read their letters, they didn't really have an appreciation for the importance of the moment, and many Americans didn't either. It was only later that the Gettysburg Address became this sacred document. So it is interesting that, you know, as you can live this thing in the moment, but that doesn't mean that you always understand the importance of what you're experiencing.
Did they like the speech?
They both thought that it was a fine speech, but, you know, Hay sort of in his diary said, you know, we went out there, the president gave a few remarks, you know, he was good, as is his wont, and you can read all the particulars in the newspaper. You know, that was all he noted at the time.
But later they made it a big deal, perhaps, huh?
That's absolutely. I mean, in their book, in their biography of him, they gave it a central place.
Right. Let's go to Alan in Madison. Hi, Alan.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you?
Good. I love Abraham Lincoln, but you hear from black people, and you also hear from other people that the war really began as a matter of the banks in the South versus the banks in the North. Could you tell me about that theory?
Well, thanks, Alan. There was at the turn of the century, the turn of the last century, you know, early 20th century, there were a group of historians who were trying to come up with an alternative theory of the Civil War, and they argued that there were competing economic interests, North and South, that used the slavery issue in order to prosecute what was at the heart of it, an economic disagreement between the two regions. That's a theory that doesn't hold a lot of water these days, particularly as we've noted that, in recent years we've realized that the North and South actually had some very complementary economic interests. You look at the relationship between cities like Boston and states like Massachusetts, which had, were deeply involved in the cotton trade and then in the production of cotton into finished goods. You look at the trade between the Midwestern states, both North and South, in terms of their agricultural products and even the role that the Tidewater region had played in the tobacco trade nationally. It looks more and more like these, the North and South had slavery was actually something that fueled both of the economies of the North and South. And at the end of the day, I think most historians today would argue that slavery and the constitutional issues growing out of the debate about whether it should be spread into the Western territories was really at the heart of the matter. But there are still, there are still some who believe that that the war was fought over abstract economic interest as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Alan, for the call. I'm always interested by how people change when they see some things that they didn't know existed in the world. And I was interested in your descriptions of Hay visiting freedmen's schools staffed by white abolitionists in the South. He had not chosen politics as a career. Hay had not. But he was really struck by what he saw there, wasn't he?
He was. We know that a lot of Northern soldiers, Union soldiers, when they actually confronted slavery on the ground as a fact and they saw that institution, it converted many of them who hadn't necessarily been strongly anti-slavery or anti-slavery at all. It converted many, many Union soldiers to the cause of the anti-slavery movement. We know this from their diaries and their letters, and historians like James McPherson have done some fine studies of that phenomenon. I saw the same thing with Hay. Hay went south twice during the war for extended periods. Lincoln sent him south in mid-1863, and then again in early 1864 on various political and military missions. And Hay spent a lot of time, particularly in 1863, visiting freedmen's schools. These were staffed by Northern abolitionists. There were large portions of the South where slavery basically had died as the Union Army came in. And there were all sorts of institutions like the freedmen's schools that were being put into place in order to help slaves transition to freedom. And Hay was deeply moved by seeing these, what he called these young ABC denarians, these young students. He was deeply moved by the sight of black and white children learning in the same schools in some places, which was not a too frequent occurrence,
I'm
but
sure.
He saw it. And he was deeply moved by their almost religious fervor for Abraham Lincoln, a man whom they didn't know much about and hadn't met. So this profoundly changed his thinking about slavery and race. And by the end of his first trip in 1863, he's writing back to Nicolay and saying that you've really got to press the president to enlist more black troops because this is really important.
Let's go to Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen. It's a really interesting show. I just happened to be reading a book by, I think it's Jamie McPherson, called Pride by War, which talks about Lincoln's presidency and his actions as commander-in-chief. And Hayes mentioned a number of times, although I don't honestly recall Nicolay. There were just two things I thought that maybe your guests could comment on. One, with respect to McClellan, it shows two things, I think. One, it shows how desperate they were for generals that could do anything. McClellan wasn't willing to fight and probably wasn't very able to fight, but he was great at getting the army's morale up and organizing things. And so he brought him back, even despite the fact that he had been really quite insubordinate. He brought him back a second time just because he felt he was the only guy that could get the army back together after one of its many defeats and the Army of the Potomac. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that I thought was fascinating is Lincoln just seemed so willing to listen to a variety of people. And I think that probably speaks to exactly what your guest is talking about, is about how influential these two young men were, because Lincoln was really willing to listen to others' views and adopt those views when they made sense to him.
Those are important points. Joshua.
Well, I think that the piece about McClellan is really very interesting. I think you're exactly right. I mean, McClellan, you know, I think when historians look at McClellan today, they categorize their thoughts about him in three ways. Some people see a Democrat, a partisan Democrat, who was never particularly interested in fighting an anti-slavery war. That's probably the most anti-McClellan position one could take. Some people see a soldier who, you know, was a soldier's soldier and cared deeply about his troops and was very, very reluctant to actually place them in harm's way and believed that at the end of the day you could win this war through maneuvering. You're maneuvering your way in and capturing particular cities like Richmond and doing it somewhat bloodlessly rather than, you know, as General Grant came to understand, doing it in a way that, you know, would rack up a body count, which is ultimately how that war was fought. And the third perspective, I think, is that he was, you know, which our caller really pointed to and placed in sharp relief, is the idea that McClellan was a brilliant trainer of troops, but didn't know how to use them. I think there's probably a lot of truth. There's probably some truth in all three of those perspectives. Hay and Nicolay were pretty brutal on him, though. They hated him on a personal level. They thought that he had been entirely discourteous to the president, and also thought that he was borderline treasonous. And they were also incensed by McClellan's post-war memoirs and writings and speeches in which he really denigrated Lincoln. So I think they felt that in the service of building Lincoln up, they were going to have to knock McClellan down. So they were not only the first ones to share the story about how McClellan snubbed Lincoln when the president went to see him at home. They also focused at length on McClellan's kind of botched response on the eve of the Battle of Antietam to a discovery by a Union private of General Lee's battle plans. And they made quite a bit of the fact that McClellan knew basically all of Lee's movements and plans and the numbers of troops he had aligned, but that he basically sat on it and didn't act on it, and that the battle was ultimately much bloodier than it needed to be. So they really took him to the mat because they believed that he had it coming to him and that they needed to do so in order to really assert Lincoln's military prowess.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mike, unless you had more. Mike is gone. Thank you very much for the call. You write that Nicolay had revered Lincoln from the moment that they first met. And I'm wondering at what point Hay said, and what made him say this, "I believe he will fill a bigger place in history than even he dreams of it." Lincoln did so many big things in his presidency. Was that Emancipation Proclamation, was it the signing of that that made Hay say that, or was it just looking at this man day by day?
I think it was looking at him day by day, and I think, you know, when Hay wrote that too, you know, he was beginning to understand that when you added all of this up, when you stacked it all up, the president's, you know, role in forcing emancipation on the country, his role in saving, you know, they believed they were saving the very idea of constitutional democracy because, you know, the United States was one of the very first democratic republics in the world. And you know, Lincoln believed, and they came to believe, that if he allowed it to die, that the entire concept would die everywhere in the world. So I think that they believed he was instrumental in doing that, and saving the very concept of democracy. And so Hay, sometime toward the middle of the, you know, Hay, who had been very skeptical of politics and politicians, who basically took this job because he thought it would be interesting, and he thought it would be a lot more interesting than studying the law. but he really, at the end of the day, he really wanted to be a poet. Right on the eve of on the eve of the election in 1860, he wrote to his old college girlfriend and basically said that he still, you know, considered politics to be a sort of dirty business, and he was still thinking of, you know, pursuing a literary career. He came to think that Lincoln, you know, was this masterful figure, and certainly he came to believe that by the middle of the war.
And his poetry served him well down the road, right?
That's right. He actually did become a noted poet in the 1870s. That's John Hay. Ironically, you know, when he was in college and attempting to write poetry, he was writing these dreadful verses that were imitating, you know, high Victorian poetry, and they were too much. My editor actually made me cut off a good amount of what I quoted. She said it was actually just too dreadful to fight through. She was probably right, but. You know, Hay had always been embarrassed of being a Midwesterner, and he's writing all these apologetic letters to his college friends talking about how he was going to go back to the barbarous West and leave the East behind and so on and so forth. But I think during the war, he came to see Lincoln as embodying a kind of Western genius. You know, he saw all of these Eastern elites who he had once really wanted to emulate, and he saw them being almost, you know, inferior to his Western president. He came to take great pride in his region, and so he wrote a collection of poems in the early 1870s called the Pike County Ballads, which were done in the vernacular of Southern Illinois, Northern Missouri. That world he had grown up in, and he embraced that vernacular, and he did better by it.
We'll take more phone calls. We're celebrating by talking with the author of a newly released book about Lincoln's boys. Today is the 205th anniversary of Lincoln's birth, and Joshua Zeitz has written a fascinating book that looks not only at these two, probably underwritten about personalities who really deserve our attention from the Lincoln time, John Hay and John Nicolay and the War for Lincoln's Image. They, from Illinois days on, had an eyewitness account of Lincoln's thoughts and his movements, and they were active in helping to listen to policy, and later on wrote the definitive 10-volume history of Abraham Lincoln, which also gave us a different kind of view of the Civil War than what was being generated shortly after that war. We have yet to talk about this whole process of publication and who tried to write the Lincoln biography immediately. Lincoln's law partner, interesting stories about that, and about later on, when more of the papers, the Lincoln papers, I think it was in 1947, were unveiled at the Library of Congress. So, and how the book was received and all of that. So we'll continue on our conversation and welcome more of your calls. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Abraham Lincoln this hour of the program, and also about his secretaries, the boys, Lincoln's boys, John Hay and John Nicolay. Our guest is the author of Lincoln's Boys, Joshua Zeitz, who has taught American history and politics at Cambridge, Harvard, and Princeton University, is the author of several books on American political and social history. I believe Hay was with the president when he died. Was Nicolay as well? And how did they respond to the death, to the assassination?
Nicolay was actually out of town. He was returning from a brief trip to Cuba, which was just a small holiday for him. Hay was at the White House basically having drinks with Robert Todd Lincoln that evening. And when they found out that the president had been shot, they ran down to Peterson's boarding house. And Hay was there all evening and was at his bedside when he passed away. Nicolay found out about it about a day and a half later. As his ship was pulling into a port in the United States, they saw the flag at half mast and heard the rumors, and he knew instantly it was true. They took it as a really profound shock. I mean, it was they went into a deep state of depression, particularly Nicolay. Hay didn't leave as much of a first person account of what went through his mind, but we have Nicolay's papers or his letters to his fiance, and they were personally crushed. You know, for them, it was the death of the person whom they, you know, admired and respected most in the world. And he had been like a surrogate father for them, particularly for Nicolay.
Mm-hmm.
So it would take years for them to really get past that.
And when did they decide, I think it was much earlier, that they had decided that they were going to do a biography of the whole administration and of the president?
They had thought about doing it as early as during their White House tenure, and had evidently they had talked to the president about it, and he had suggested that he approved of the idea. The idea really, you know, after he died, they moved to Europe and took diplomatic posts. He had actually appointed them to those diplomatic posts before he died. They had been planning to leave the White House for the second term because they were burnt out. But, you know, Nicolay got married and had a child. They went to Europe and spent several years there. Then when they returned, Hay became one of the editors of the New York Tribune, and he also married and started to have a family. But by the mid-1870s, they were deeply distressed by the way in which Lincoln's memory was being distorted, not only by the kind of northeastern snobs like Charles Francis Adams, who was, you know, making this argument that Lincoln had essentially, you know, ceded control of the government to William Seward, and that only because Seward was such a strong leader did the government survive in those dark years. They were disturbed by that, but they were also, as you hinted at earlier, disturbed by what people like William Herndon and Ward Hill Lamon were writing. I mean, those were two of Lincoln's old friends who were trying to humanize him in a way that the Lincoln family and Hay and Nicolay thought was deeply crass. I mean, they basically drew him up as a coarse Midwesterner. And they didn't like that either. They thought that he was much more than that. So they sat down, or they talked a great deal with Robert Todd Lincoln in the early 1870s. And by 1874, Robert agreed that it was time for them to actually correct the record. So he gave them exclusive access to his father's papers. They actually took custody of them, and they maintained custody of them until Hay died in 1905, at which point the Hay family sent them back to Robert. But those would be closed off until 1947. Thus ensuring that Hay and Nicolay would have, you know, effectively have the last word on Abraham Lincoln, or at least that was the intent.
And your epilogue, I love that description, goes to 1947 when Carl Sandburg and others are in the room waiting for those papers to be opened. I could just imagine that scene. It was great.
Yeah, it was, you know, it's literally, you know, this is 21 years after Robert died. This is almost half a century after Hay and Nicolay died. And all of these scholars and writers and poets and newspaper men are at the Library of Congress, you know, at the stroke of midnight, waiting for the papers to be unsealed.
Great.
And they, but you know, they hadn't been so much as touched since Hay and Nicolay.
Well, let's go to Lee in Oconto. Hi.
Hello, Kathleen, and Gertrude, your guest. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you. Approximately 1975, my wife and I stopped at Salem, and we visited the bookshop, which was run at that time by the Illinois Historical Society, and they had a full set of the Hay Nicolay books, and that one had been sold, and she said they got them in periodically. And so I said to them, you know, could we asked about ordering the set if you ever got one in. And sure enough, they called. So we drove down from the side of Green Bay and looked at them. They were in beautiful condition. And they boxed them up, and we took them back up north here. And he said it was the first edition. I never knew much about them because I was more familiar with Robert Sandburg. And I'm wondering, first of all, a lot of people said we waste their time and money buying those books instead of just getting the Sandburg ones. But I'm wondering, do these books still have value? How can we preserve them and make sure they stay in the pristine condition?
Yes.
It's funny. Well, it sounds like you have a better collection than I did. They've recently been reprinted, so I have modern paperback editions of them. I don't have the real one, so I envy you on that.
Ah.
I've seen the first editions because a lot of college libraries have them, but I haven't. I don't own them. It's a great, great question. I think if you look at Carl Sandburg, whose volumes on Lincoln were just, you know, they were written with the lyricism of a poet, so they're just beautiful. And you know, you read Hay and Nicolay, and they're very kind of workmanlike in their approach to their prose, in part because they were trying to find a common voice. The thing about Sandburg is that he is regarded by scholars to have been one of the most beautiful writers about Lincoln, but one of the worst historians. We mean that in the kindest way. Because he wasn't a professionally trained historian. He was a popular writer. So he would go around and collect everything he could find on Lincoln, and he pretty much used every single source indiscriminately as though each was equal to the other. And the result of that is that he's using a lot of source material that probably has been discredited. So they're wonderful. I remember reading them when I was in high school and thinking that they were just these beautiful, beautiful imaginations of Lincoln, and they're still a terrific example of American literature, but I think they don't hold up historically. Hay and Nicolay, there's a lot to offer in the 10 volumes. You know, it can be a plotting experience at certain times when they go completely off topic because they're really trying to frame Lincoln around the context of his days. The days and times in which he lived. So they can leave Lincoln aside for 100 pages and go off on a tangent about, you know, a particular political issue and not return to Lincoln for 100 pages. So for modern day readers, that can be frustrating. I think some of the sections that deal with the the Lincoln White House and the actual machinations within the White House are probably particularly interesting and hold up really well because they were there and they could speak to it authoritatively.
Yes, it'd be fascinating.
Yeah, I always tell people, not that I don't want people to read my book, of course, but if you want to read...
Oh, they should, though. I'll tell people to read your book.
No,
it's
thank
okay.
you. I was going to say, when people ask me what's the best one-volume biography of Lincoln, a proper biography of Lincoln, I always tell them that my favorite is David Donald's book, Lincoln, because I think it actually is... It probably he takes a lot from Nicolay and Hay, but he, it's the best one-volume treatment I've seen.
We had a caller who asked if I was going to read the Nicolay Hay biographies, and I need to ask you that question. Should we all be reading them, at least some of them?
I think that it's a bit much for – if you're an ardent fan of Lincoln, then they might have some value for you. I think that – you're talking about 1.2 million words. So that biography was important for its time. Most people at the time, it had hundreds of thousands of readers, but most people didn't read the full set. Most people were exposed to it because it was serialized over a period of 5 years in the Century magazine, which was at the time the widest circulation and most popular magazine in the country. That's where most people got their exposure to Hay and Nicolay, and about a third of the work was serialized in that magazine. If you really are interested in it, though, and don't want to commit to 1.2 million words, which I wouldn't blame you for, Nicolay actually condensed it to a one-volume abridged biography in the 1890s, and I think that they're both credited on it. So if you can find the one-volume one, that's probably not a bad one to read because you'll get an understanding of how they wrote about Lincoln without having to commit the next 5 years of your life.
Well, and I hope that somebody gives you, as a result of doing this book, the whole 10-volume series. If anybody on this planet should have it, I would think it's you, Joshua.
That may be, but my wife has told me that I have to find a place for all of these books that isn't in our living room. So.
That's where all our books are, too. It's all right. Where else should they go? It's good
exactly.
to have books in the living room. Thanks, Lee, for the call. Let's go to Paul in West Dallas. Hi, Paul.
Hi. In comparing the writing of history, Doris Kearns Goodwin, in her recent book on Teddy Roosevelt, comments on Ida Tarbell and her work, and she implies that Tarbell and Hay didn't see eye to eye as far as Lincoln is concerned. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, I think it was actually Nicolay who had a bad exchange with her. They probably neither of them probably liked what she was doing. But so Ida Tarbell was working for McClure's magazine, and at the turn of the century, they wanted to do their own Lincoln series, and she went to Nicolay and asked for help with that, and also asked for help in getting Robert Todd Lincoln to give her access to to his papers. And according to Tarbell, Nicolay said, this is sort of like my turf, and when you intrude on it, you're making my enterprise less valuable.
Right.
I don't know that he actually said that, but they probably didn't take her seriously, in part because she was a woman, and as their editor at the Century sort of laughed at this and said, look at that, Sam McClure, or S.S. McClure has got a girl to do a life of Lincoln. They all sort of thought they didn't take it seriously. Lo and behold, she wasn't given access to the Lincoln papers, so she went out and scoured the country for her own materials, and she actually found a ton of source material that spoke to Lincoln's early life and early career that Hay and Nicolay didn't even know existed, and even Robert Todd Lincoln later said, that her work proved a really important adjunct to the Hay and Nicolay volumes. But you're right, they didn't think too much of what she was doing.
Thank you so much for your call, Paul. Is this your favorite time in history to study and to write about? You can hear it in your voice, and it's certainly in the writing. It's a very engaging book. It is a fascinating time, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, it's certainly one of them. It's up there because you look at particularly the arc of how Americans thought about slavery and freedom, and you look at the politics of the 1850s. It was a decade where you really saw important big political debates that resonated on a very fundamental level with Americans at the grassroots level. So it's an exciting narrative. And if you look at how quickly the country changed, in the immediate aftermath of the war, There was a congressman from Ohio who effectively said, you know, I look at my country and I don't recognize it, thinking back 5 years. I mean, it was a period of just sweeping change. So it's pretty exciting for an historian to look at.
Yes, and here's to Abraham Lincoln on his birthday.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us, Joshua.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I did too. Joshua Zeitz. The book is Lincoln's Boys, John Hay, John Nicolay, and the War for Lincoln's Image. Just been published, and he is has been a professor at Cambridge, Harvard, Princeton University, and has done extensive writing on American political and social history for a number of publications and has written other books as well. So, loving that conversation on this Abraham Lincoln's 205th birthday. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Tomorrow we will be with you, and during this hour we'll speak with the author of When Hollywood Was Right. Great conversations ahead.